Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, a podcast celebrating chick lit and the so-called guilty pleasures you're sort of done feeling guilty about. My name is Caroline Donahue, and when I released my first novel this year, I found myself being asked the same two questions over and over again. One, did I think of my novel as chick lit? And two, was I offended if it were called that? Which is weird because all the best women I know are also devoted fans of chick lit, and this podcast is dedicated to examining what's good, great and occasionally questionable about the genre. Today I'm joined by the author of the Sophia Khan Is Not Obliged series and the forthcoming This Green and Pleasant Land, Aisha Malik. We're talking about Bridget Jones' Diary by Helen Fielding. Hi, Aisha.
Hello, and yay. I love Bridget Jones.
Oh, I'm so excited.
I could talk about her all day and all week and all year. And actually, that's why I wrote my first book, because I was so obsessed with her.
So where did your obsession begin with Bridget?
I don't think I read the first one first, actually. I read The Edge of Reason first for some reason.
Oh, that's weird.
I can't remember why.
Yeah.
I remember I was going to New York for the first time and I needed a book to read. And I think I saw it in the airport or something. And I basically ignored New York and read the book.
Do you remember what year it was?
It was. I was 18.
Yeah.
So it would have been the year...
19.
Shit. It would have been the year 2000.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
A pre-9/11 read.
Yes.
Maybe you should have taken it in New York a little more.
I know, right? I wasn't a scarfie back then, though, so I was okay. I was exempt.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
well,
it was fine.
You got it the wrong way around, really.
Yeah, I know.
You should have had a scarf on then.
Yes,
then.
And taken it off. I know. But I always do things the wrong way around. It's fine.
So before this conversation gets more offensive, I'm going to do a very quick plot summary of Bridget Jones. I'm sure most of you listening already know the plot backwards, but in the small chance you haven't, here we go. Anyway, Bridget Jones is a single 30-something who drinks like a fish, smokes like a chimney, and dresses like her mother. She spends most of her time flirting with her chauvinistic boss, Daniel Cleaver, and avoiding being humiliated by the posh, churlish Mark Darcy, all while getting pissed with her friends Jude, Chaz, and Tom. Also dodging Spanish Inquisition-style attacks from the various smug married people in her life. And that's basically the whole plot. It's woman has a job, has two love interests, and there you go.
Yeah, and it kind of sounds so basic, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But it's, anyone who's read the book will know, it's not basic. It's bloody brilliant satire, amazing characters, and this one central character who you will just inevitably fall in love with. Or some people hate her because... Some people have like weird hang-ups about her because she's not intelligent enough, or maybe she's just...
Yeah, and she was really divisive even then. Like, this wasn't like...
Marriage-obsessed.
Like, yeah. Like, I was doing a little bit of research and like, this wasn't like a slow kind of thing. But like, because they were, Helen Fielding was doing these columns already, and then it got turned into a book that was a ready-made audience for Bridget.
Yeah.
And as soon as the book came out, smash hit, but also people being like...
Marmite, right?
Yeah.
Like, I hate her. And I loved her.
Right?
Yeah, I did.
But it's a weird thing because, like, there were so many women, like, millions of women who were like, this is the first time I've ever seen a woman in fiction who was like me, who was as insecure as me, who was as, like, concerned about, like, you know, can I have a boyfriend and still be a feminist, and can I do this and can I do that, and, like, am I practicing feng shui in my flat enough? And all these mad insecurities that she has but are nonetheless really real.
Yeah.
But then, so you have all these women who are relating to her, but then at the same time, there's all these women being like... why is she such an idiot? And then the women who love her are like, am I an idiot?
Yeah.
Like,
well, probably yes, but that's okay. We're all idiots
we're
to
all
some
so
degree.
Dumb.
But also, that's the point of satire. That's the point of comedy. Like, you know, she doesn't have to be this amazingly intelligent person to be related. I can see where people are coming from, but also that's kind of, I think that's the point of why Helen Fielding created her. She was just kind of a really stripped down version of perhaps every woman out there in terms of insecurities, and you can be a high-flying career woman as well as be obsessed with, you know, how you look and how much you weigh.
Yeah.
And Bridget Jones was just kind of, showing that stripped down insecurity.
It's really interesting reading Bridget now, because obviously we're in the, it's so boring to talk about, but we're in the post-social media climate.
Yeah.
Where everyone is, even if they're doing this personality on Twitter or Instagram where they're like, oh, I'm just a mental slob, there's still a showmanship to it. But when you write from a diary perspective, it's the struggle with it, and I'd love to ask you more about this, is creating somebody who really does think they are alone and really does think that no one's watching.
Oh yeah, that's quite interesting.
How did you find writing Sophia Khan that way?
Well, I ended up merging both, because it's in diary form. I mean, it's such a Bridget Jones ripoff in the sense that it was my first book, so I was like, you know what, I'm going to be play it really safe with this, and I'm just going to openly kind of admit that this is a Muslim version of Bridget Jones, because I love Bridget Jones, but also Sophia Khan doesn't drink like a chimney. No, drink. That would be
drinks
weird.
Like a
drink
fish.
Like a fish. She does smoke like a chimney.
She does.
She doesn't dress like her mother. And she's Muslim, so she doesn't have any of the sex.
Which is good to pepper the plot. It's good to sort of
keep
the plot moving.
Will she have sex or will she not?
Yeah.
So what she ends up doing is she ends up having to write a book about Muslim dating in the book. So it becomes kind of meta like that. And what that involves is social media. So it kind of ends up integrating the two by using the book to broach that divide between being a diary format, which is very lonely, and being more kind of
Because she keeps a blog, doesn't she?
Yeah,
Sophie?
She keeps a blog, which isn't actually integral to the book, and it's kind of just introduced as a way to show her popularity online. But yeah, I think it's kind of important in order to keep it up to date, because not having that element wouldn't have really, not having any social media element wouldn't have rung true to the character.
My first novel, I also had this struggle of like, I really resent. I don't resent is probably the wrong word. Maybe it is. when novelists, they don't acknowledge the real world around them. So like when like people don't go to the toilet, or they don't use the internet, or check their emails on the toilet.
Or they don't eat like a jar of Nutella on their own
in
front of the television. That was sad, wasn't it? Me admitting that. But yeah, no, it's true. Yeah. Or when female characters don't eat anything but salads, that really pisses me off.
Yeah. Or even when female characters are so stressed they can't eat. It's have you ever experienced stress?
No, that doesn't happen.
What was your relationship? Because I read the book, I think because I have an older sister, I'm sure you do as well.
Yes, I do.
She brought the book into the house when she was like 18 and I was like 8, I think. And I remember like flicking through it because her and my mum were talking about it so much, and then I gradually read it when I was about 13.
Okay.
And then I read it like every 5 years since then, on and off. I kind of come across it when I'm moving house and I end up sitting on the floor in the boxes just like reading.
It's just like, it's chicken soup for the soul, isn't it?
It really is.
It's like Harry Potter. You just read it for comfort and just...
It completely is Harry Potter in the sense that you just feel like you can just step back into Bridget's London.
Exactly,
Which I kind of wish I lived in British London.
Yeah,
I live
too.
In this London, which sucks.
What are you going to do? You can't have it all.
Yeah. What I really like about Bridget Jones' Diary and how they use the diary format in general, Helen Fielding, is that she never has two good or two bad days in a row. Like,
right,
it's always like, great day, I had loads of sex with Daniel Cleaver, and the next day hasn't called.
Yeah,
and the next day he talked to me again, and the next day he hasn't. And it's like,
and it's not even the daily thing, it's the tiny thing. I felt like the fact that it's 8:01 and then it's 8:05 and the difference between 8:01 and 8:05, whatever might happen, it just chimed so much with our everyday life. Having a croissant at a cafe and then running into your boss like 7 minutes later, and that kind of familiarity, the madness of London life, and merging love and career, and that madness comes together in that format. And if it wasn't in that format, I don't feel like it would have been as successful.
It's great. You kind of have to like suspend your disbelief, and because like obviously anyone who really keeps a diary doesn't be like, oh,
exactly,
la la la, I am completely on time. Oh no, now I am very late.
Unless you're Adrian Mole, who tries to replicate that in one of his books.
Does he?
Yeah. Which one was it? I can't remember which book it is. I'm rereading Adrian Mole, which is why it's come
I'm to also
mind.
Rereading Adrian Mole.
Oh.
I'm on 13 3/4 right now.
Oh, I'm on the prostrate years.
Oh, I kind of left him at about 25, I think.
Okay.
I don't want him to get any older than that.
And there's I can't remember which book it is, but he does allude to Bridget Jones coming in the scene and him saying something about her character writing a diary, and then he's writing a diary except she's writing it more successfully than he is. He tries to emulate her. It's very funny.
Oh my God, I had nine. Now I do want to read that. So I assume you read this in 2000, that you come back to it every few years the way lots of people do. Every time I come back to it, I feel like I get something new from it. Mm. Like when I was, I think when I was a teenager, I took everything she said at face value, at like, oh, Mark Darcy really must think she's terrible, and so she really must be as fat as she says she is. Yeah. And then as you become more worldwise, you realise that 8'13" is a very thin woman.
Oh my God, so thin.
So thin.
I'd kill to be that thin. Maybe I shouldn't say that.
No, well, I'm going to tell our listeners right now, I am 10'11". I am 10'11" and reading this book has made me have an eating disorder.
I am not going to give away my weight.
I thought we were doing a thing. I thought
no,
we were going to be
like... No,
we're
not doing a thing because Caroline is about 5 inches taller than me. So that stretches it out a bit.
We also have very heavy boobs.
We do.
Yeah.
Thank God this is a podcast. Otherwise, that'd be really weird.
You look like a fellow heavy boober.
I am. I mean, I could show you now, but that would really be weird.
No,
but she, you realise actually that she is her own worst enemy. And that the lens through which she sees herself is completely distorted. And you're right. And actually, you don't get that when you read it as such a young person. And as you get older, you think, actually, this woman is mad. She's got body dysmorphia.
Yeah.
And her hang-ups have no kind of placing in reality. It doesn't make any sense. But then that's just... Being alive as a woman, isn't
it?
Like, we all have insecurities that make absolutely no sense to other people. Maybe they do. They just don't say it to your face.
I think that's why I find satire at the moment is in a really weird place, because I feel like everybody wants to represent women as being like these kick-ass, badass feminists.
But that's a lot of pressure, isn't it?
I want a funny woman who's also like a kick-ass feminist.
Yeah. Without any kind of hang-ups. And actually, one of the things that I was criticised about in my book is the fat phobia. And the fact that Sophia Khan is obsessed with her weight. And I was like, but this is what writing is. You're writing about a character and her hang-ups. And that, I feel, is really true to life. In retrospect, would I like her to have been a bit more kind of aware about the kind of message she was putting across? Yeah, probably. But at the same time, if you're not going to address women's insecurities in books, then you're basically creating characters that aren't flawed and therefore not very fun to read or interesting to read.
Completely.
Because they're not relatable.
What I really love as well is that throughout the book she references Susan Faludi's Backlash, but she's never read it. And it kind of has this weird...
So on point, isn't it?
It's so on point. Because like, what's the most recent important book that you haven't read?
Everyone keeps on going on about Susan Sontag, and I feel like I've read her just because I hear about her so much. And I haven't read anything of hers, but I see her everywhere.
Right.
I know that's... She's
I still haven't
old,
read Rachel Cusk yet because
no,
the cover
I...
of that new book looks weird. It looks like the inside of a vagina. I don't like, I know it's a shell.
It's the Eye of Mordor. I like to think that I've read things that are really important and pretend I have, just because it feels like I have, because people bang on about it so much.
But that's completely Bridget's life.
Yeah.
Is, and I like, and speaking of like coming back every few years and getting something new out of it, I think the last time I read this book before the most recent time, which was yesterday, I think I was 23, and I was kind of knocking on the outside of Bridget's world, in that I knew people who worked in books, but I still worked like in recruitment, I think, in like this really like boring dead end job. And even the jobs Bridget deigned to do, I would have loved to have done, like researching for a TV show or working at a publicist office at this big publishers. And now coming back out the side of it as someone who's almost 30 and who has worked in these industries, you know, has put out a book and therefore has worked with book people and the people who surround those industries, I see it as something else now.
Of course,
you know?
Yeah.
And the incredible snobbery that she pushes up against.
Yes. Yeah.
Like that party scene where she, for Kafka's motorbike, which I love.
Oi! Oi! Sorry, the mic's not working. I love that scene so much. It's so brilliant. Oh, I'm having
a
moment.
We never like find out what Kafka's motorbike is about.
That's the point,
I know,
guess.
I love it. And it's so good in the film, but it's so good in the book as well, because like it's completely a conversation I've definitely overheard or been a part of.
Yes.
Of like all these people, like Perpetua and all her posh friends who've been to Cambridge. And this is also something I forgot, is that basically everyone she works with, like, and Daniel Cleaver and Mark Darcy, they're
Oxbridge,
all Oxbridge.
Yeah.
And she feels completely outside herself, and she went to Bangor. I don't even know where that is. And like how small she's made feel all the time.
Yeah.
And I just related to
that's
that so much.
Relatable. That's so relatable, isn't it?
Yeah.
You've worked in publishing. I mean, I worked in publicity for 2 years, and part of that appeal was also because I'm like, I'm basically Bridget Jones.
Yeah.
With a scarf. I'm in publicity. And every time I'd pick up the phone, I'd be like, hello, publicity. And I did actually once meet Salman Rushdie.
Did you?
I did. He was lovely. But I really wanted to say to him, do you know where the loos are? I didn't, because I probably would have
and
got
yours,
fired.
Mr. Archer, are quite good.
Two. Yours aren't bad either. But yeah, no, I mean, some of the stuff that I heard, one of my colleagues, she was brown as well. She was Sri Lankan. And she once went to a party, and an author came up to her and said, oh, you're quite exotic, aren't you, for Chatto? She was like, okay.
Oh.
And
oh dear.
I remember doing some publicity PR. I was a really bad publicist, by the way. Sorry,
I'm
Christian,
sure you were a fabulous
I'm
publicist.
Sorry, Christian, if you're listening to this. He's my boss. I had some phone conversations with him, and I ended up mentioning that I was fasting because it was Ramadan. And he was like, oh, right, okay. And then he called maybe a couple of days later, got through to my colleague, my boss, and he said, yeah, I need to speak to that Muslim girl.
At least he remembered you.
And she looked over at me and she's like, what the fuck? So yeah, those were very kind of Muslim Bridget moments, I like to call them.
Oh,
very
wow.
Bridget, but very specific to being Muslim as well. Which is why I wrote Sophia Khan. Have I plugged my book enough, do you think?
No, I think we can hear another time.
Yeah. That's why I wrote Sophia Khan.
Well, I love that, because like obviously that experience that you just mentioned is like that Bridget of 1994 or whenever this was written probably wouldn't even know what Ramadan is or whatever.
Aww, Bridget.
Do you know what I mean? And she'd try really hard to understand,
yeah.
But otherwise
Aww.
She'd be like, what? Like, so no chocolate.
Ooh, no chocolate.
Yeah.
No
and
water.
You have flashcards. But what's sort of universal about it is anyone who's ever made to feel like they don't belong in a situation can relate to Bridget.
Absolutely, which is part of her appeal, and which is why I get really annoyed when people kind of belittle the book for being not important in a way, just because it appealed to so many people. And I love Bridget. And
it's kind of similar to how people talk about and feel about Sex and the City.
Yes.
Because you and I are both big fans of Sex and the City.
Yes.
I think it's weird that like when people talk about like Bridget Jones or Sex and the City or any of that kind of like whole culture of like
female centric,
yeah,
sister solidarity.
Yeah, women
feminist.
In cities generally in the mid to late 90s, that kind of stuff. They always focus on like, oh, well, and there are negativities, the way that like those shows, you know, maybe treated gay people or people of colour, or maybe just didn't include those people at all, or maybe like Sex and the City got really materialistic.
And actually, like, sometimes reading Bridget Jones, and I hate to criticise it, or Sex and the City, but you do think their focus on men and dating actually is very much in the past. And that's the one aspect that I feel like is kind of anti-feminist, because their focus is so based on men and how to get a date and how to get married, that it doesn't feel fresh anymore as a result of that.
That's very true.
Yeah.
And I always feel, maybe I only feel this way because I often, because I'm in a long-term monogamous relationship, I feel like that nobody ever talks about like struggles within relationships, because those things are always set up to be like, oh, they're going out with someone for like 2 dates and then there's something wrong with them and then they go. And then that man is never seen again.
Yeah. And that's why I wrote the sequel to Sophia Khan.
Which I haven't read.
I wrote it in very much a bit of a blur, really. So I don't remember much of my own novel, to be honest.
You just
it's
told
a great
me that.
Great plug there.
Yeah. First time I met you, I told you I was working on my second novel and you were like, oh, don't worry, you won't remember it.
Basically, don't worry too much about it. It's just focus on the third novel once the second one's out of the way.
Yeah. That's the real winner. Mm. That's that Man Booker Prize shortlist.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So when people talk about like Sex and the City, Bridget Jones, even like Girls to an extent, they always emphasize on the negative things and how like, oh, it's always like how expensive their things are and all this long list of complaints that you could have about any TV show or book.
Yeah.
And they always seem to miss the thing is that, like, you know, people saw themselves in this, you know?
And, you know, TV is aspirational. Books are aspirational to a certain extent. So you kind of need that in a sense, just because it's looking, it's reflecting your own life and it's kind of showing you a possibility for yourself if that's what you want, you know?
For me, the aspirational stuff in Bridget Jones is definitely the friend group.
Yes.
And I love, like, even now I feel like I've got a really great group of friends, but...
But basically they're not good enough, is what she's saying. Caroline's friends.
No, but the idea that they were like, you know, Bridget could have a really tough day and just, like, Shazza and Jude and Tom would just assemble and they'd all get pissed. And then at 2 a.m. she'd be like, bloody great night.
But in reality, it takes you about 4.5 weeks to get a day in the diary with all your friends in London because someone's out of the country or someone's too busy at work or...
I mean, the reason we keep doing podcasts together is because it's the only way we can seem to hang out.
Basically. So, yeah, it's kind of... Yeah, it was a bit unrealistic, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I loved that, though.
Because then, because you still do have the great friends. Yeah. It's just, you know, it's not as easy as that, but... that's part of what made it so heartwarming. And there's nothing wrong with heartwarming, by the way.
Absolutely nothing wrong. And like, I really...
I love heartwarming.
I love heartwarming.
I really do. I really, really don't like it when people don't like heartwarming.
And I also really like when stakes are relatively small.
Why not?
You know?
You know? Exactly.
Like... I sort of vaguely resent the and I really like both these authors, like the kind of Jojo Moyes and Gillian Flynn, where someone either has to be dying or already be dead in order for us to have to care. It's like, why can't the stake be that you really fancy someone and you wish they'd kiss you?
Don't you think that's just because it's publishing? Because you have to have like some kind of unique selling point. It has to have a hook.
Yeah,
and if will they, won't they kiss is just not a big enough hook, I guess, unfortunately.
I think it's a big enough hook if you're writing a book that's specifically aimed at a commercial women's fiction.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Like if there's a picture of like a picnic blanket and a flower on the cover or like a woman's shoe and a heel, you know? But anything outside that genre, it's like, oh, well, who cares? You know, well, why
that's not, true,
you
know?
And then there's like that other genre of
maybe
like,
there should be like a literary fiction book about will they, won't they kiss. Would that even work?
Well, I haven't read Normal People yet, but apparently that's what Normal People is by Sally Rooney.
Oh, yes.
I haven't picked it up yet, but...
Oh, that, well, that might be interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe we can do like a two-person book group, read that, and then discuss.
Yeah, we must be the only two people who are reading that book.
Yeah, exactly. No one else is reading it, obviously.
I want to talk about smoking.
Oh, yeah.
I love writing characters who smoke.
Me too.
It's so great.
It's so cathartic.
And I'm never going to write a character who vapes, I don't think.
But you could kind of do it ironically, couldn't you?
I suppose. Yeah, but if you were really trying to say something about that character.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah, exactly. Oh, actually, I wrote a character in my third book who vapes, who's just given up. But he's a very minor character. Yeah.
I've read your third book.
Yeah, his cousin, Vaseem, that comes.
Oh, yes. Yes, he's, oh, he's, I like vaping. Him. He's got a van and he vapes.
Yeah.
That's all you need to know.
And he sells dodgy stuff.
Yeah. But when I'm reading Bridget Jones, it's very apparent because, like, I suppose when you read it back at, now that you've like written a novel or two, you know why people smoke so much novels, because like it breaks up the action in a really nice way.
That's true, yeah.
Because you don't end up with like, I said, he said, I said, he said. Yeah. It's like, I said, you know, reaching across for a cigarette and lighting it, flicking my ash. There's so many things you can do with a cigarette that livens up dialogue.
That's so true. That's a very professional way of putting it. and it says a lot about the character.
Sophia Khan smoked a lot.
Yeah, she smokes a lot because I felt like... she is a character who I wanted to be universal, despite the fact that she's a scarfie. She wears a hijab. Mm-hmm. She doesn't drink. She doesn't have sex. And I was like, you have to give
her some vices.
Yeah, you have to give her some vices because praying is just not going to cut it, to
be honest. I love to pray.
I love to pray. I know. I mean, what a dickhead she would sound like otherwise. So, yeah, she does smoke a lot. And I just felt like it was also just very true to the character.
Yeah.
And it was funny because there were lots of things that I could do with her trying to hide her cigarettes from her parents and especially her dad, who also smokes.
But it's different when the woman smokes.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously, Caroline.
It's common.
Oh no, it's disgusting.
You're a woman of the street.
Yeah, basically. You shouldn't be allowed to wear hijab. You shouldn't be allowed to do anything. So yeah, I thought it added a layer of complexity to her. And because there aren't many Muslim characters in books, I thought I would create a character who kind of subverts expectations.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was important for her to smoke.
We talk about this a lot off air of like, because you're a Muslim Pakistani writer, I'm an Irish writer.
Are you going to use the R word?
What's the R
representation.
Word?
Representation.
Representation.
Hello.
Well, nobody thinks that like inviting me onto a panel is representation because they're
it's true.
A white blonde lady.
Aw, bad luck.
And then afterwards, if they're really scrabbling around, they're like, oh, but you know, we got flack on Twitter, but Caroline's Irish.
Everyone should invite you on panels. You're great.
I really enjoy them. I think I'm the only writer alive who just says yes to all of them because I love getting out of the house. But like we've talked a lot about how like people want like a certain thing from a Muslim writer. And I also found that they want certain things from Irish writers as well.
Yeah. I know what they expect of me. They expect some kind of a book that deals with something really serious.
Yeah.
Some kind of subjugation going on, some kind of oppression, maybe an honour killing or two. You know, that's
spice things up.
That's spice things up. That's the kind of vibe you get from people who think about a Muslim character. And it's about framing narratives around the bloody headscarf. Oh my god,
yeah.
I never want to talk about the headscarf ever again. It's so boring. But that's what's kind of expected, and because it's kind of in vogue, right? Everyone's talking about the burqa and the veil, and you just kind of get a bit bored of it. You just don't want to talk about that. You want to talk about Bridget Jones.
Yeah. Well, the weird thing with Sophia Khan is that what was subversive about it was that it was so traditional.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that
yeah.
You took this, like, just this ordinary London girl who also happens to be Muslim and is just sort of, like, dealing with dating life and what we talked about before, which is, like, quite small stakes of, like, just finding someone to love.
Yeah.
Which actually is the biggest stake you could possibly have for most people in their lives. Most people aren't finding out who murdered someone from a train.
Why can't women look for love in literature? Like, in a way that's not twee.
Yeah.
Why is that, like, I feel like you can't be a feminist unless you're kind of anti all the tropes that we have to deal with. So that looking for something as simple as looking for love is kind of anti-feminist, but it shouldn't be.
Yeah.
Why does it have to be a bad thing?
Or the male lead has to be the sort of a perfect kind of wokey feminist man who always says the right thing.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And that's what I did like writing Sophia Khan for the reason that it's a rom-com, right? It's totally a rom-com. Even though so much of it is about looking for love, actually, it's about many other things. And what I loved about a lot of reviewers was that they recognised it as a kind of feminist narrative, even though it's a love story as well, because it's a love story not just about meeting a partner, but also a love story for friendships and a love story for families and between sisters. So it's a kind of universal love story, not just focusing on finding...
You're a bad publicist. Your publicist is really happy with you right
now. I know,
now.
Right? Well, I'm a very good publicist for my book.
Yeah,
clearly.
Somewhere in London, a publicist is just like glowing. I'm like, what's happening?
It's other people's books that I can't be asked about.
Because most of them
suck. That's not true.
Most books by other people, not in this room, are bad.
Exactly.
It's interesting that you say that, like, a deceptively simple narrative about like a character looking for love can actually have a load of nuance and be the carrier for many other things.
Yeah, I love being able to write about serious issues in a really lighthearted way.
Yeah.
Because I just think that life is nuance. Not everything is black and white.
Yeah.
And if you're going to be a writer, then it's not about having an agenda about, you know, making people see things a certain way. It's about throwing out questions, making the reader think about those questions and think about how they would answer that. It's not about telling people what's what.
No, I agree with you. And like the nicest thing that one of the nice things anyone's ever said to me about my book was that like it feels like you went in with questions and came out with more.
Oh, which is wonderful. Right? Which is exactly what you want.
Right? Like yeah, you want to like, well, I went in and it was complicated and now it's more complicated. And that's the sense you get from Bridget as well.
Yeah.
Is that she never quite, I mean, she does get together with Mark Darcy in the end, but she always has that thing where she's never truly herself around anyone, you know?
No.
And Mark does really like her for exactly who she is.
Yes, yeah.
But mainly because he's so sick of his entire class,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like every time you meet Mark, he's being like primped by a woman he hates. Mm. And he's just blinking a lot. Have you noticed how much Mark Darcy blinks?
Poor Mark. She's almost too good for him, isn't she? Just because he is the kind of ideal, and I'm using air quotes here, mm-hmm. He's kind of seen as the ideal man. But actually, she's so mad and so wonderful that he's almost too safe for her.
Yeah, and it is, I think because when you're reading it, she kind of is so hard on herself and she has so many crappy experiences with men and with the people in her life. And then when like Mark just shows up being kind of quietly earnest, you're like, oh, lovely.
Aww.
But like, looking at it objectively, like what is Mark Darcy? He's wealthy and quiet.
And like how is that going to be fun long term?
Yeah. Like
if Helen Fielding hadn't, this is a major spoiler, by the way, hadn't killed him off in the third book.
I haven't read it.
I haven't read it either.
Oh, right. No interest, really?
No, which is really weird because I'm obsessed with Bridget Jones. I love it.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to because I almost felt like killing him off was kind of takes away from everything that could have been explored in a so-called happily ever after situation.
Yeah, which goes back to what we were saying earlier in that like I feel like almost nothing ever deals with the long-term sort of story of being with someone and trying to love them year after year.
Yeah.
Not that I have any problems with that. My boyfriend, if you're listening.
absolutely. And why in my second book, I was like, actually, yeah, I'm going to write about marriage because I have so much experience in it, having never been married.
You have many husbands.
I have many husbands. No, that's the wrong way around. It's the men who are allowed to have many wives in Islam.
I thought you just reinvented
the
whole thing.
Not yet.
Okay. You're working on it.
I'm working on it. Working on it slowly but surely.
As long as they all have the same amount of money that you give them, it's fine, right?
Oh, yeah. Obviously.
all give them their pocket money every week.
Equality matters. with the second book, I was very keen to explore marriage and, spoiler alert, and the breakdown of a marriage as well.
Mm-hmm.
For the very reason that you said that no one actually looks very, you don't really look at Happily Ever After, do you? Although David Nicholls' book Us is an amazing book on a kind of, on a marriage between two people after 50.
David Nicholls is One Day.
Oh my God. And it's just, it is beautiful. It's such a great book. I highly recommend it.
It's funny that you bring up David Nicholls because the other day I was interviewing for this podcast Ava Rice, who wrote The Lost Art of Keeping Secrets.
Oh, okay.
And she was very frank about how Chicklit is packaged. And she said David Nicholls would not have gotten that cover for One Day if he had been a woman.
Yeah, and I've said that at panels before.
Yeah.
And I loved One Day. I really loved it.
It was a nice book, yeah.
It's a great really nice book. But absolutely, if he was a woman, it would have been packaged in a completely different way. The journalist Satnam Sangare, guy who wrote Boy with the Top Knot, he also wrote a book called Marriage Material. And if he was a woman, it would have been packaged in a completely different way. Mm. Marriage Material.
Yeah.
Hello, that has like chick lit written.
It would have like a woman's hand on the thing.
It has chick lit written all over that title.
Big engagement ring.
Absolutely.
Big like cartoon diamond. Yeah.
So much of how a book is packaged is about your gender. And that feels slightly kind of unfair. It kind of takes away from how important these so-called, I hate the term chick lit. Mm. I can't stand it.
I don't mind it personally.
Do you? I can't stand it.
You've been cringing in my intro.
Because it's kind of derogatory to because the implication is that it's not important. When you say chick lit, the implication is that it's kind of too fluffy or not important or just not good enough. But so many of the books that appear to be chick lit or women's commercial, like Bridget Jones, like Marion Keyes' books, like Jane Austen.
Mm.
They deal with so many relevant, important issues.
Yeah.
And to call them chick lit, to call any book chick lit, I just really wish we could just do away with that term for all books.
I personally don't mind it. I only think that, like, people have assigned that. I feel like we can reclaim it, basically.
Yes,
I feel like we can take it back.
Different.
And I feel like that's what I'm trying to do with this podcast.
So I'm the wrong guest to be invited then.
You come into my house. You insult my word. No, but I totally know what you mean. But I think because you
reclaiming
are...
Reclaiming it would be nice. Making it into a positive term would be really,
yeah,
really lovely.
I like chicks. I like lits.
yeah, it would be nice to reclaim it so that people didn't kind of weren't snooty about it.
Yeah.
And that's what I don't like, just the snootiness.
I think there's no getting around the fact that these are books that are marketed to, like, a mass female audience.
Yeah.
And that's the reason why the love stories are charming.
Yeah.
And the pratfalls are funny and the descriptions of clothes are very interesting.
Yeah.
Like, there's a reason for that, because that's what women like reading about. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, calling it chick lit is a fine shorthand for that, and rather than saying commercial women's fiction every time. And
but
yeah,
even women's commercial fiction, what the hell is that? I hate that
love
term.
Stories, clothes, falling over.
I realise it's all marketing, but it really annoys me. Even women's commercial, what does that mean? That a woman wrote it and
it's for
the main
women.
Character is a woman. It just really irks me. Probably because, like we were saying earlier, that books like One Day or Marriage Material would...
Nick Hornby as well. Who,
exactly.
Like, aren't reading Nick Hornby. Women read Nick Hornby to learn about men.
Oh, God, Nick Hornby. I love
him. I love him.
I think he's wonderful.
But High Fidelity has a coolness attached to it, even though it's a rom-com.
I actually haven't read High Fidelity. What have I read?
Oh, it's one of my favourite books.
Oh, really? Yeah. I must read it. But he generally is a great writer.
Yeah.
And... yeah, I think my annoyance comes in the fact that there seems to be this kind of unfair attachment to how women get published and how men get published.
Mm-hmm.
And my bugbear is that when these great books get published by men, they're marketed in a certain way, whereas when these great... they're marketed in a way that are crossover, right? Mm. Women and men read it. Mm. Whereas when women write great books of similar ilk...
Yeah,
they
it takes
don't have
so
that
much for men to read them,
because I've had such great feedback by male readers for Sophia Khan of all books, because you know the cover and what it's about, and it's a rom com, it's essentially chick lit, but it's, you know, I've had men say that I'm not going to read this on the tube because of the cover.
I've had that also. Yeah.
So, and your cover is actually,
it's got a rose on it.
Yeah, it's such a beautiful cover.
Oh,
I love
you.
It. It's gorgeous, but it doesn't scream chick lit, and it doesn't scream women's commercial.
Yeah.
There's still a bit of a kind of scope for a crossover there.
Yeah.
Even though I know what you mean, because there is a rose and it is yellow and kind of pink as well, isn't it?
It's weird though, because it's like almost like the chick lit, we'll put that in inverted commas, that gets taken either seriously by the sort of literary fiction brigade or whatever.
I love that you call them the brigade.
They're a brigade.
And I absolutely love literary fiction as well.
No,
so,
as do I. But I think that it only gets picked up by that sort of circle once it's like, oh, it's chick lit with a twist, you know, whatever. And also... what's interesting with literary fiction as well, like I read this year Rachel Kushner's The Mars Room,
okay,
which is set in a women's prison and is like a brilliant, one of the best books I read this year and totally deserved to be on the Man Booker prize list, and it's quite gritty and it's quite violent, but the cover was like bright pink with like a heart on it, because but it was like, if it had written by Jonathan Franzen, it would have had the whole like, this is important man writes about women's prison, so it goes both ways, like at every level of book there is like that weird gendered skew,
and I guess that's just the way marketing works.
You've
got not much you can do about that, I suppose.
So I'm sure you'll agree with me, because we've referenced it a few times, that the film is one of the most brilliantly adapted books of all time, and also the perfect film.
Yeah, absolutely. It really is the perfect film. I can't think of any adaptation that's as good as that, apart from Lord of the Rings, randomly. which I loved. That's sure. Probably another podcast.
little known film. Little known indie New Zealand film.
Yeah, Lord no, Renée Zellweger is just perfect for that. But I haven't watched Bridget Jones for a really long time now, partly because I now refuse to watch anything in which I am older than the characters in the film.
Oh, because it's just, you're going to run out of films, man.
I know, dude. I know. There's always something's got to give about... two people
you
in the
love
60s.
That film.
Yeah, I really, really love Something's Gotta Give. It's bloody amazing.
You're a great publicist for your books and the 2004 film Something's Gotta Give.
Have you watched it?
No, I still haven't.
Have I? Did
yes,
I mention it
you
to
have.
You? Did I?
Yeah.
Oh, God, I'm obsessed without even realising.
Oh, yeah.
It's so good, though. It's
I
so
will
wonderful.
Watch it. Actually, my boyfriend's away this weekend, so I'm going to mainline rom-coms, and that's going to be one of them.
That, and The Family yeah. Stone is great as well.
I love The Family Stone.
Love The Family Stone. So
another...
uncomfortable and so brilliantly done.
SJP
yeah,
is
she's wonderful in it.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I think one day SJP will be regarded the way Meryl Streep is regarded now. Like, she'll eventually start... No, I honestly believe she's as good.
Okay, you know what? Let's have a podcast in, like, 20 years' time and revisit this conversation, shall we? But she is brilliant in The Family Stone. And I think that's also a really perfect film that shows that romantic comedies
can deal with a host of issues,
can be funny and heartwarming and talk about really difficult things.
Yeah. That scene where she's like, why would you want your son to be gay?
Yeah, oh my
and
God.
It's the most complicated, strange, horrible, but you kind of see where she's coming from, but also she's a monster and you're like, oh,
it's just so perfectly done.
But I think that the film does sort of like pile in the issues a bit, though. It's like, our son is gay and also he's deaf.
Yeah.
And also his partner is black.
Yeah. can we talk about chick lit and not address Nora Ephron?
Oh, yeah.
Like, she's another author who kind of...
She's got a weird status, doesn't she?
Yeah.
In that she is one of those writers who is universally respected, universally
yes,
adored
yeah. Yeah.
by people who read Joyce will love Nora Ephron, and people who read like one book a year and it's from Asda will read Nora Ephron.
Yeah,
like Heartburn
so
is the crossover thing.
It's
you know?
Just so brilliant. I don't know why I brought her up, just because.
Because
I
she proved over and over again that you can like make charming, likable, lovable films and art with nice people who you want to spend time with, and also talk about like, you know, gentrification and you've got mail or like...
Yes! That's exactly what I was going to say, word for word.
Yeah.
So thanks.
Well, Aisha, I've got to wrap up now, but I've loved this conversation so much. Do you have anything to plug? I think you do.
Yes, I have a new book coming out in June 2019 called This Green and Pleasant Land. And I'm very excited about it, because it's a bit different to what I've written before, and it's about a village, a quaint English village, and a Muslim family in that village, who the main character of which is suffering a bit of an identity crisis, and he is asked by his dying mother to build a mosque in the village, and the mayhem that follows. I'm very excited about it.
I feel very smug and lucky to have been one of the first readers of it, and I absolutely adored it. I think everyone who listens to this podcast will adore it too.
Thank you.
Because the characters are so lovable, and the world feels so relatable. And okay, there isn't like a massive romance in it, but I think you fall in love with these characters in a huge way, and people are going to love it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Aisha. This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's Czaroline, or email me about the podcast at ZaroLineO'Donoghue@gmail.com. We'll be back next week with a new episode of Sentimental Garbage, where I chat to Ella Risbridger about Millie's Fling by Jill Mansell. Thanks to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the logo, and Acast for the recording space. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast, produced by Hannah Varrell.